All I have to say this evening, and it's also all that I know, is what I read in the daily announcements, but I'll repeat that in case you've forgotten what you read. That the theme of this evening's panel, and I'm not quite sure still who it was who's responsible for mounting it, is the church confronts revolution. We have three panelists up here who will arise and speak in one mode or another, the first of whom will be the Reverend Ralph Mulring, whom you know, who's pastor of special ministries for his district out in Berkeley, California. And then secondly, Louis Wright, whom you can't see, but he's on the floor up here in front, who is a graduate student in history at Leland Stanford University, who will have slides to project with commentary on some recent student-faculty police confrontations in the Bay Area. And then third, the Reverend James Sudbrock, a pastor from the Bronx, who will speak in his capacity as a resident of the urban situation. So without further ado, I'll ask Pastor Ralph Mulring to lead off with an introductory statement to introduce the subject, and then with a short position statement which represents his own contribution to the panel. Ralph?
Thank you, Bob. Well, it's good to be here and have this opportunity to share with you some of the concerns that we bring from the embattled zones of the West Coast, and to have a chance to discuss with you this whole serious question, as I would understand it, of the church in confrontation with revolution on many levels today. I would like to do two things simply by way of introduction here. One is to make a formal introductory statement, and then secondly, to perhaps in an informal way indicate how it seems to me that the church relates to the current situation. Everywhere in our cities, on college campuses, in Africa and Latin America, we are engulfed in revolutionary change. The Church of Jesus Christ cannot be faithful to its mission without confronting this inescapable reality and without seriously inquiring how it can respond constructively to the crisis of our time. No doubt there are temptations to be avoided. A detached neutrality which refuses to cope with difficult problems, war, racism, poverty, is irresponsible. An exuberant activism which deals obsessively with structural change and clamors for relevance to the neglect or loss of congregational worship and personal ministry may also be reprehensible. But the mandate is there, to move with God's momentum in history, to give substance and shape to the new creation in Christ, to recognize the positive opportunities for service in a revolutionary situation. No Christian who is aware of the dehumanizing influences in the world today, the deprivation and alienation, can be content to merely uphold the established order, much less lend his support to the use of repressive violence. Under the righteous judgment of God, there must be shattering upheavals. Precedents may be found in the admonitions and dire warnings of Jeremiah, Amos, and Hosea. The apocalyptic model of the New Testament gives impetus to the prospect of radical transformation. If we simply consider the eschatological portions of the Gospels and Epistles, and especially the book of Revelation. No prevailing institution, political or ecclesiastical, can be exempted from the scrutiny of God and the possibility of dissolution. No man-made organization can be absolutized as ideal or beyond repudiation. What was once useful may eventually become anachronistic and detrimental. Creative innovation may be essential to fulfill the purposes of God. The beneficiaries of the new covenant in Christ may be called upon to be participants in the revolutionary change which may necessarily precede Reconstruction. Even though we strive to minimize violence, it may become our vocation under God to endure conflict, to augment desirable change, even as we await ultimate reconciliation. Now, this is my formal, semi-theological introduction. I would simply like to suggest, in moving the panel along here and expediting, hopefully, the discussion, to perhaps make a few observations that you are all fully aware of, but I think what we need is the context for this evening's discussion. I think what we need to realize, be reminded of once again, are the immense, vast, far-reaching changes that have really overtaken us, both in our urban situation and on the campuses of this country. The change I'm referring to particularly from the era of emphasis on integration and civil rights of the late 50s and early 60s, to the militant shout for black power, to the increasing radicalism and the increasing number of confrontations in city and on campus. I think, just by way of personal observation here, of the tremendous contrast between the years 1953 and 1958, when I was privileged to serve in the ghetto on the west side of Chicago and developed a fully racially integrated congregation, and my return to that congregation as a guest preacher last summer, to find a great warmth and reception on the part of the black people with whom I had been acquainted and to whom I had ministered, but to recognize that there really is a psychological gulf when one comes into contact with the new youth, those of high school and college age, and to discover that a couple of the children that I had baptized and helped to instruct are now college militants. This is the change. Again, I'm sure you're aware of the change in student outlook, the move from passivity to what we might call confusion to today a combination of alienation and rebellion, a combination of having dropouts, hippie communities, and the various types of student activists. In my own experience, I sort of develop a chronology along this line that I date the beginning of the real change with the spring of 1960, when the so-called riots broke out against the House Un-American Activities Committee in San Francisco, with then the film Operation Abolition being shown the following year across the country. And for the first time, something new happening, that in all of the colleges there was an intense reaction, favorable or unfavorable, to the showing of this film. And then in 1964, it was at our locale where the free speech movement erupted, and again the reverberations went back and forth across the land. And since then we've had the strike in Paris and the eruption in Columbia, Cornell, Harvard, all over. It was the resistance, the opposition to the Vietnam War, which no doubt has accentuated all of this. The anti-war movement I would see as being in the middle of this whole struggle for justice and what students and militants would say directed against imperialism today. But another observation I would make is that as of 1967-68, it seems to me you have a shift, and this coincides, I suppose, with the assassination of Martin Luther King, from nonviolent to more militant tactics. So that a year ago, last October, in the Resist the Draft Week, we could in Oakland have for the first time efforts to blockade the streets and to deliberately goad authorities into confrontations. And we could have this last year a total impasse in California as we find liberal administrators caught between an ultra-conservative state administration and an ultra-radical type of student on the campus, so that it has become indeed a very bad day for the liberals of the 1930s to the 1950s, who have now fallen upon difficult times. And just to illustrate this, we ran through three presidents, I think all of them excellent administrators, fine gentlemen, but none of them could weather the storm at San Francisco State College. And now we have, Louis and I have just come from the West Coast, where I think you see a new stage of development in the latest escalations at Stanford and at Berkeley, especially in what has now been referred to as the Battle of Berkeley, where you have almost had open street warfare. Now, what does all this mean to the church? I would submit that this is the issue that should concern us and that we should go into dialogue on. I would conclude with simply this observation as a clergyman who has his roots deeply in the history and tradition of the Missouri Synod, that I think we find it peculiarly and particularly difficult with our tradition to cope with this kind of crisis which confronts us, because we have proceeded with caution. It has been our tradition to be opposed to revolutionary movements, to uproar, to tumult in society, and for us now to make a constructive contribution in the situation in which change is going so rapidly and one crisis follows immediately upon another, I would submit is extremely complicated and difficult. It requires drastic readjustments on the part of many of us. Nonetheless, it is inescapable, and so let's get with it and do it.
Fifteen other slides that I took when I happened to be in Berkeley during the day of the People's March, and they had this large group of horticultural enthusiasts who were thronging the street. And so I didn't know exactly where this People's Park was, and I started walking down to where all the people were, and there I came upon the whole thing. And I had my camera, so I pulled the thing out, and you'll see some of the results. And then about 10 or 12 of the final slides don't really have anything to do with student disorders or anything like that. I think they represent, at least to my way of thinking, what might be a constructive possibility. In other words, something for city planners to keep in mind if we have a day, which a lot of people are predicting, when we'll have many, many millions of people who are crowded together in urban areas, and people are wondering how can all these people live together peacefully. I think the Californians have come up with something, and I'll show you what it is when we get to it. First of all, the big thing that I appreciated about Berkeley before I found out that it was the center of political agitation is the fact that it has the best button shops in the country. And you can get all of these buttons, and to be anything today on a college campus, you have to wear a button. So in California, you can get everything from the religious things, like Jesus was a beatnik, or I had my Sunday school button, Win with Jesus, and I could have worn a little more controversial one. This is for churchgoers. Take a Viet Cong to church this Sunday. And then for draft dodgers, there would Christ carry a draft card. And to really stone them, you show them this one. God is watching, so give him a good show. This is, again, Sunday school level. And then if you are musically minded, you can be very non-controversial unless you run into people who do not like Gustav Mahler. This is one called Mahler Groove. It's from the Gustav Mahler Society of Southern California on Wonderland Avenue in Los Angeles. I got this at what is it, Hollywood, this big place where they have music concerts in Hollywood? Hollywood Bowl. Yeah. And for those who are a little more sedate, like Carl Barth and their choice of music, you have Mozart forever. Barth would have loved this. And finally, one which Art Hoppe, the political satirist of the San Francisco Chronicle, who probably next to Art Buchwald is one of the best political satirists we have in the country, he had a campaign last fall called Somebody for President, and he even had a button he was handing out. He also came to Stanford last year and gave a talk proposing a solution to all the world's problems in one generation, and he called it total birth control. He found one person to take him up on it, and this is a young lady named Stephanie Mills, who graduated from Mills College this spring. And the title of her talk was The Future is a Cruel Hoax, and if you read about it or saw it on television, she advocated the best thing she could do in view of the increasing population of the world was not to have any children. And President Pfister of Stanford was in the audience at the time, and he was supposed to give the main address. And I got this from a girl who had typed all of his speeches for him, and she said he had all kinds of witticisms and jokes that he had put in to make his speech go over. And he was so shocked that, according to the paper, his mouth fell open, and when he gave the speech, he left out all of his jokes and everything. He's so taken aback by this. I think if you can shut the lights off already. I'll go through these fairly rapidly without much comment, and I think if you have any questions, I would prefer that you keep them until later, and then we can do it as a... I'd rather do my part of the talking more as an answer to questions. These pictures were taken at the sit-in at Applied Electronics Laboratory in Stanford. This is part of a group called the April 3rd Movement. It's mostly a coalition. It was not really the SDS which led the confrontation in this case. The leadership was provided by the Resistance, which was mostly an anti-draft and anti-war organization. A lot of it was aimed at either research which was going to the war or which students thought was contributing to the war effort. And I took some of these pictures in order to indicate that it's not only people who wear beards and the so-called hardcore radicals, but the fact that you have a lot of ordinary students, or at least from the outside, they appear to be ordinary students. And I think you'll see in the course of these pictures, and even in the course of the Berkeley one, that you can't judge the kind of person you have at a college demonstration by the way he looks on the outside or the kind of clothing he wears. This was during one of the open meetings which the movement would hold. They had a microphone set up, and they were so democratic that sometimes it would take 4 or 5 to 6 hours to even come to a decision. And in several cases, the meetings went so long, like 1 o'clock in the morning, that they simply had to table it until the next day. This was taken at the height of the sit-in, about the second or third day. Next. Another view of the... This is right outside the laboratory. It was being occupied at the time. And then the meetings were held in an open courtyard. Next. Can you focus a little better? Is it, can you see okay?
No.
Yeah. No. Okay. Next. You notice especially the short hair, the clean blouses. Okay, next. This is another, somebody, this is a lady named Mrs. Joan Robinson, who is an economist from England. They said the students were so angry with the professors, they decided to hire their own, like the University of Paris people did in about the year 12 or 1300. So they imported this lady from England for 1/4. And when she heard about this, they asked her to come out and give a sit-in discussion. So she held a teach-in, and they had all these people gathered around listening to her. And the next few are from this episode. Some people refer to this as a Stanford style, because supposedly at Stanford, whenever they have a sit-in, or at least the last 2 years, it's been so peaceful, at least in most cases, that they even took their books with them, and the reporters are all amazed. They come inside, they sweep up behind them all the time, everything is spotlessly clean, and they always have their books with them. In this case, it was because finals were just coming up, so they had to cram. Next. An interesting picture, this is Dean Napier and his wife. Dean Napier used to be Old Testament lecturer at Yale, and is now the dean of the chapel at Stanford. He's another one of these people that Dr. Mullering referred to who gets caught in the middle, who is being attacked at the same time by the radical students because he isn't radical enough, and by the conservative students because he isn't conservative enough. And they were writing things on his window. I think one time they even had in their conservative paper, they had a picture of the Stanford chapel, and then the caption was, "Why not try this for the next sit-in?" Next. See this some more at the laboratory. Next. Mrs. Robinson giving her teach-in. This is an interesting picture, too. The man on the left is Paul Rupert, who is working out of the Resistance and the United Campus Ministry. He spent 1 year in the University of Chicago Divinity School and decided that that isn't where he wanted to finish his theological education. So he came out and he was working with the ministry staff at Stanford, and then he became involved in the sit-in, and he was more or less the moral leadership of it. So this was an interesting phenomenon where it was not really the SDS, but a coalition with primarily nonviolent pacifists in charge of the movement. Maybe this had something to say about why the Stanford movement was comparatively nonviolent for such a long period of time. And this is a discussion he was having with Dr. Wolfgang Panofsky, the head of the Stanford Linear Accelerator. You may remember, he's the man who went to Washington, and he had been a friend, or David Packard knew him, and supposedly had a consultation with him. And then Panofsky argued that the only consultation had been about 5 minutes at the airport. And then Panofsky went to testify his opposition to the ABM system. And it was interesting to listen. They went for about 2 hours with Paul arguing for the sit-in clause, and then Dr. Panofsky arguing as a sympathizer, but giving reasons why he would be against this kind of action. And I think it was a good example of this kind of dialogue that can take place in something like this. Next. Another picture of the same thing. Next. That's Dr. Panofsky. Probably is one of the leading radar and one of the leading scientists in America today, and you would never guess it from the way he was dressed. But I had the privilege of serving on a faculty committee with him, and he's one of the finest people I've ever met. As an example, on his own, he had decided on a program to get about 5 black teachers from southern universities to come to Stanford for the summer. And then there would be 2 purposes. One would be to upgrade their own skills in technology, and the second would be that they would hopefully go back to the South and recruit students who could come to graduate school at Stanford. So he hopes in a few years he can sort of build up some kind of contact like this, and you can have more black students on elite universities. Next. I didn't know if these would turn out. It was pretty dark, so I took extra pictures. Next. That's another one of the same thing. Next. This is a pantomime group which the people who were conducting the sit-in gave. And I think this has something to do about rational dialogue and how they were trying to talk to the administration, and the only thing you seemed to get was nothing. And so you had the tapes across the faces. They call this the guerrilla theater, and I think it was pioneered on San Francisco State. And you'll find this a lot in the West Coast and the Bay Area. Even the grape strikers in Southern California picked this up, where you may have seen pictures on television where they'll have people playing the part of the grape grower, and the part of the strikers will be played by the strikers themselves. Next. This is a picture of the one-day boycott that the war research movement, or the anti-war research movement, conducted after the sit-in had been ended. And they felt the demands weren't really met, so they tried to stir up some more interest by having a boycott of classes. These are 2 people who are with me in Renaissance Reformation history. The girl on the left in New York City, where her father is the dean of New York University, and he's right in the middle of this whole thing on the other side of the coast, from the administrative angle. And I was talking to him around Easter time, when she was up in the Peace March in San Francisco. And he said, he said, not knowing as much about professors as he knows now, but since he's a dean, he said, if he were our age today, he would probably be protesting too. The fellow on the left is a good seminarian from Princeton Seminary, who is studying with Dr. Spitz in, I guess it's on John Calvin and the Council of Trent. So you can see he's getting his studying in too. This is a man from the history department. I think it's Professor Bailey, who's Professor Emeritus there now. Next. This is sort of a formal portrait of them, so they don't smile very well. It's not that they're angry at the world or alienated that much or anything like that. Next. This is a classic. It's a prized possession I have in my slides. It's Dr. Spitz, with his green book bag over his shoulder, engaged in rational dialogue with Lenny Anderson, who came from the University of Chicago. It's funny, Chicago seems to get in here, for those of you who are alumni or connected with it. Lenny came out, and after 1 year, got so turned off by the entire program, I think he was dropping out this year. So he was trying to persuade Dr. Spitz to join him on the picket line, and the man monitoring it in the middle is our Princeton seminarian, or ex-seminarian, Ted Castile. Next. This is what the general student area looked like when the strike was on. And this is sort of like a bomb shelter that the people put up. And then this was sort of the headquarters. And it so angered and aggravated the people in the community that the Palo Alto Times was arguing that Stanford was, well, how do they put that now? I guess a seedbed for revolution, and therefore this kind of thing should come down. What they did is they put up, the trustees were meeting, and they wanted an open meeting, but the trustees were afraid to even hold the meeting on campus. They held it in San Francisco, a good 40, 50 miles away. So what the students did is put up this great carnival, and they had to spin the wheel, and then you could spin the wheel to find out what the students will do, what the faculty will do, and what the trustees will do. And one faculty member was so angered by the faculty responses given that he tore it down. To which they simply put a sign up, you know, this was torn down by a faculty member, and then they had it lying on the ground, so you could see what had angered him. some of the responses were interesting, like, what will the students do? Well, one of them was burn the place down. Another was run away. And a third was start their own university. And different answers like that, ranging all the way from ludicrous to somewhat sensible. Next. Now we shift locale to a little more active portion of the Bay Area. This is Berkeley, Sproul Hall. I think Tom Hayden of the SDF was speaking at the time. I didn't know it until later. And I was having lunch at the time with Paul Ramshaw. Some of you may remember him from the seminary, and he's going to school now, I think, in political science in Berkeley. It's a fairly peaceful and quiet crowd. It's the only time I've ever been on the Berkeley campus when there were a lot of people around, so I have no way to judge what campus life is like. It's much more exciting than Stanford. Next. This is sort of the general mall from Telegraph Avenue coming in toward the main area of the Berkeley campus. Next. This is a group of about 100 people, evidently from the SDS, and they had their flags with them, and they were going around campus, and I don't remember what they were singing offhand. They would sing songs, and then it was sort of an anti-white racism march. I think this was when the regents were meeting on campus, and I didn't see it, but I'm told they marched up to where some of the National Guardsmen were guarding the regents meeting, and they tried, I guess, to walk in or to demonstrate, and then they were politely shoved aside. Next. This shows the Berkeley campus in its more peaceful moment. That's the Campanile, is that how you say? Campanile? Next. This is, I suppose, what you consider a typical group of students on Sproul Hall in the steps. A lot of good folk singing going on when you and I was there. Next. Now, these pictures are during the People's Park March. I was taken by the religious connotation of a lot of the signs and a lot of the things. I can elaborate on this later on. This one was, Eden was a park. Next. This is a car, a call car, the Berkeley Police Department. This one had all kinds of flowers on the top, and about four of the guards were stationed along the side of the march, all having flowers coming out of their helmets and out of their uniforms. And after I had taken the picture, a man drove up, I guess one of their officers, and I heard one say to the chief, he said, "Chief, we've got the most photographed car in town right now." So, next. This is our student chapel, Dr. Mullering's chapel, and they were using it, I guess, as an emergency hospital in case anything had happened. And since no violence happened on Memorial Day, they didn't have to use it. But I thought it was an interest. I didn't know if he had a picture of it or not, and I thought it would be worth taking. Next. This is right outside the corner of the so-called People's Park, and this is a line of National Guardsmen in their uniforms and with their rifles and bayonets. Bayonets about like this. And this is a group of people more or less eyeing them sort of warily. Next. This is White Way, about a block up from the People's Park. I got hosed down by a hippie while walking along. And in fact, the hippies and the street people were cleaner than most of the tourists because they had all the hoses on, and they were spraying everybody, and all of these second, third floor, fourth floor apartments had music going full blast, and they had a street dance, and then they would simply water everybody down with the hoses. So it was sort of a big holiday festive there. Next. I took some of these to also indicate that it wasn't simply all these terribly dark-looking bearded people and people sloppily dressed, but good, clean, average Americans who go to these things. Next. This is right outside the fence. You can see the evidence of Stanford's presence, Stanford A3M, standing for April 3rd Movement. You may not be able to read the sign here, "Thou shalt love thy pig as thyself." A new application of the Golden Rule. And you can see the guardsmen with their pup tents in back. You can still see some of the trees that have been planted by all these horticulturalists before. Next. This is sort of a successor state to People's Park. And I wanted to get a picture, I didn't get him, I guess, in this one, of one of the leading radicals at Stanford, busily engaged with a pickaxe, trying to hammer, this was a parking lot before, and they were digging the thing up and planting all this instant sod, you know, funeral home type, and then they were watering it, planting all these trees. I never saw so many gardening enthusiasts in my life. Fantastic. Next. This is a fellow who was dressed as General Hershey, and if you can lower it a little bit, you can see his hat. Can you lower the picture a little bit? Yeah, it's all kind of missiles
coming out from top.
And see, I don't know if you can read his paper or not. Seven board arrested for kidnapping cops or something, I forget.
I can't read it.
He was going up to the guardsmen and sort of giving them a bad time. I also heard some exchanges, like several people had a bottle of wine and they were offering it to some of the guards as they went along. Three of the girls stripped completely down to the waist and they had sort of a topless dancing show on a truck right in front of where the guards were stationed behind the fence. Supposedly the guards, who were not on duty, ran to get their cameras and they were seen busily taking pictures. This is the kind of thing you expect in California. I also heard probably the most interesting exchange is a fellow who was talking to a guard. He said, "You people are okay down here, but I wish you'd tell your buddies up the line to smile a bit more. They're the most uptight bunch I've ever seen." Next. This is my answer to the whole business about overcrowding and urban slums and people's parks and maybe even student activists. Comes from Marin County, north of San Francisco, near Mount Tamalpais. This is a thing called the Renaissance Pleasure Fair. It's really a hippie be-in, but by naming it Pleasure Fair, you give it historical continuity and you make it respectable. So you have all these people who are over 30 who are there having a great time. They bring babies and children and everybody is really enjoying themselves. If they had called it a be-in, they would have gotten so uptight and angry that they would never have come. And so I suggest that a thing like this is maybe what we need in the modern society, what John Maynard Keynes called the Saturnalia, or like the Oktoberfest or Fasching or the New Orleans things around before Holy Week. But this is sort of a play on stage. They do a performance of the old English morality plays. This was one on Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden. And you see God and his angels off to the right. You can see it more in some other pictures. Next. Gives you an example of some of the costumes. You come all the way from the very straight lady on the right and her husband to the very modish hippie lady on the left. So this is a study in contrast. Next. This is the morality play on stage. You can see Eve is sort of having a bad time. This is Adam to the left. The snake has all the bad lines. He's sort of stretched out prone. God the Father with his little angels are gathered here. Next. This is sort of the song at the end of the play, upon which they come out into the audience and collect for money, things like that. Next. Took this because of a lady who had her face all covered with green. I don't know how she got it. Vegetable coloring, I guess? You can see all the... You can be anything you want to be. One fellow was a slave driver from Russia, and he had all these slaves in front of him. These pretty girls who had these collars around their neck, and he was offering them for sale in the crowd. And next. This is one of the musical groups you'll see at a Renaissance Pleasure Fair. You see what the possibilities are on this thing about doing your thing. You can be as creative as you want to be, all within a sort of a structured, unstructured setting, and it's perfectly respectable, and people will let you do it. Next. Shows you all the good average families who can come to these things. Next. You can even dress up like a member of the noblesse de robe from France. A good fellow. Engaged in rational dialogue, probably a college student. Next. This is the entrance of the queen. You see her just barely in the Elizabethan costume at the right. Okay, next. There was even a place for armor here called the Society for Creative Anachronism. I was going to tell that to some pastor, you know, you could use that for an image of the church or something. Next. This is one of the many shops that you find set up. They're going to try to make this an every week affair, I think, in the future. It may not be next year, but in the next few years. So if any of you are in California, in the Bay Area, you should try to go to this. Next. I thought you'd like about three pictures of what a university campus looks like today without students, when everything is quiet. This is Stanford as very quiet as through the gate. You see, no activity of any kind, which maybe indicates that some people are right when they say the best way to end campus disorders is to get rid of students. This is why Robert Hutchins thinks that the center in Santa Barbara that they have, well, he says, all the advantages of a university without students. Next. Another feedful campus scene. And finally, the place where all the people who don't like to march around and carry signs are busy doing their thing. This is the main library, or the graduate library at Stanford. I'm told it was so noisy at Berkeley over Memorial Day with all the helicopters going overhead that about half of the students in the library at Stanford were Berkeley people who were trying to get away from the noise. Next. I think that's it.
I feel that perhaps some of you have much more experience in the area of revolution than I. We don't riot over potato chips or anything like that. I suppose what I would say is that the inner city is not all revolution at this point, as perhaps is obvious. That apathy still is one of the most important factors and the most important realities of the city. In my own ministry, both in San Francisco and more currently in the Bronx, I must confess that I have had very little connection with revolution, with the militant movement. However, I would say this, that being in a situation which perhaps is as bad as any area of New York City, but where the people still have more middle-class aspirations and hopes, however, these are the people who are moving away, so that I would imagine revolution will be coming, that certainly one begins to sense or to feel that revolution is definitely on its way. I was sitting one night at Art Simon's talking to a priest who is active at St. Bridget's, the neighboring parish, and it got to the point where we both began to express our frustration. I suppose in New York City you see this the most clearly, although I suppose it's true everywhere increasingly, that after years of working for things like better education, better housing, any of these things, even better churches, all of these institutions are deteriorating, and that all of your efforts appear to have been really wasted, almost as though you've been playing games with yourself. And you begin to have the sense that the time is coming when you can no longer honestly say to your people that the traditional means of gathering together, of attempting to talk in a logical and a sane way to the power structures, that it very soon is going to be very difficult for you to say this in honesty. Because my own impression after 9 years of it is that it is not true of our society today. That it does not appear that we are capable of changing our systems in a rational way. And that I think that it is because of this that even people in the ghetto are beginning to have the first thoughts of revolution and to say, if we can't have a part of this, we're going to tear it all down. And I suppose the difficulty that I have and hope to gain some knowledge out of all this is how does one live in this situation as a Christian? I can take a call to a suburban parish, I suppose. But if I choose to remain, what will be my Christian presence in the midst of all of this? Now, I haven't an answer, and I would hope that perhaps through our discussion maybe the beginnings of an answer will come to me.
Well, thanks to all three panelists. Now, I think you ought to fall out and reassemble over here around the table. Ralph, would you please? We'll move the microphone. Time has come for response from you folks, either in the form of questions or comments or objections, and we'll ask our three experts here to field as well as they might the comments from you. Before we go on, though, may I say a word? I said initially, and I said that in all honesty, that I didn't really know, and I still don't know for sure, who is responsible for mounting this panel discussion this evening, putting out the publicity, hiring the hall, and so on. More and more, I suspect that Ralph Mollering was. And if that's true, then I'd like to say on behalf of all of you, thanks, Ralph, for doing this. And thanks, too, now for each one of the special presentations. Your work is really yet to come. All right, I'll move this microphone over here so we can tape the responses. But I hope that those of you who speak up from the hall will raise your voices so we get your voices on here, too. Did you have something else to say, Ralph? Another speech?
I have many more speeches, but if you might grant me the privilege of making just one brief statement to throw into the hopper here for the whole discussion. I would like to explain, too, that I did not fulfill what was on the announcement, that is the sharing of at least the beginning of an effort to develop a Lutheran theology in response to revolution, but I have it in written form and can make it available to anyone who is interested. I might just say that I've tried to structure this in a quite traditional manner and have it under the headings of a theology of faith, a theology of hope, and a theology of love. But what I would like to share with you, maybe it might sharpen up a little bit the recent happening in Berkeley, beyond commenting on the picture that Louis had, to tell you also that some of our leftist Lutheran students decided to put a big banner up on top of the chapel with a quotation from Adolf Hitler, 1933, on law and order, which was taken down at 5 a.m. by the police, I understand, and perhaps a little infringement of the separation of church and state. But beyond this, I wanted to throw in this, what to me is a very interesting comparison, historical parallel with what happened in the People's Park, in this whole question which it raises, I think, for us Christians, of people's rights versus property rights. You may know that there was a group in San Francisco known as the Diggers, who helped dropouts as they came in and wanted to join the hippie colony. And this derives its name from a man by the name of Gerard Winstanley, who was the leader of one of these dissenting groups in Cromwellian England at the time of the Civil War. You had the Levellers, you had the Diggers, you had a number of these groups. And if you look up his theology, a statement of his principles, let me just share a couple of phrases with you, because it sounds almost precisely like the declarations being issued in relation to the People's Park by the students and by the street people. This is the theology of Gerard Winstanley. He says, in the beginning of time, the great creator, reason, made the earth to be a common treasury. And then he says that since human flesh, however, began to delight himself in the objects of the creation more than in the spirit, reason, and righteousness, who manifests himself to be the indweller in the five senses, then he fell into blindness of mind and weakness of heart and runs abroad for a teacher and ruler. And so selfish imaginations, taking possession of the five senses and ruling as king in the room of reason therein and working with covetousness, did set up one man to teach and rule over another. And thereby the spirit was killed and man was brought into bondage and became a greater slave to such of his own kind than the beasts of the field were to him. And here upon the earth, which was made to be a common treasury of relief for all, was hedged into enclosures by the teachers and rulers, and the others were made servants and slaves. And that earth that is within this creation, made a common storehouse for all, is bought and sold and kept in the hands of a few, whereby the great creator is mightily dishonored, as if he were a respecter of persons, delighting in the comfortable livelihood of some and rejoicing in the miserable poverty and straits of others. From the beginning, it was not so. Now, the whole thrust of much of the rebellion over the People's Park was couched in similar language to suggest that human rights call for the sharing of the blessings, the bounty of this earth with everyone, and the regents of the university representing corporate wealth are the ones who hold this plot of ground. They have neglected it. It has been allowed to deteriorate. The people have converged on it, and spontaneously, in a spirit of joyful creativity, they have caused a garden to blossom forth and a playground. And now the ruthless forces of oppression step in and set up a huge fence around this and closing it off and cutting it off from the use of the common man. This just to me was a very striking parallel between this history and what has just happened recently in Berkeley, and I wanted to share that with the group. Pardon the second address.
All right. Now, any
there
comments?
We will be the earth.
Yes.
I'm from the Bronx. An important distinction. Well, obviously my responses are very subjective. I have not thought through this at great length. However, to me, a very classic example of this whole thing, I don't know how much you're involved in this or read about it, is the thing that has happened in the New York City public school system, where people have, as you realize, attempted to make of our schools something that is responsive to community. The normal thing that most communities, for example, in the state of New York have. And the fact that when it came to a confrontation, strike was called, that inevitably it was the teachers who won, and that ultimately through their pressure, the whole law that came out of the state of New York, which is a very ambiguous thing, but appears finally to not vindicate the hopes of the people to have control over education, but rather will continue to contribute to the gradual deterioration. I guess I'm viewing it mainly from the point of view that it seems to me that many of the things that people are most concerned about, particularly things like housing and schooling and such, at least in the city of New York, I don't judge other ways, places, these things are actually getting worse year by year. And that ultimately when confrontation takes place, we begin to see things like well, just in New York City, the nomination of Procaccino and Markey, two ultra-rightists by the two major parties, that that the Gulf and the needs of the Gulf seem to be expanding. And I see no, at this point, I see nothing happening of any significance to ameliorate it. Now, this is my judgment of it.
Is this inherent in our system, or is it something we have abused?
Gee, I'm this second panel today, I'm in over my head. I think it's natural for those who have to want to keep what they have, and those who have not to want to have, I think we have, my impression is that we have perhaps, at least in these latter days, not, our society does not seem to be capable of responding to the need.
I'd like to comment on that. I think you have an example of this attitude strongly against this present system on the university campus, where you have very many of the student militants who feel that the American system as presently organized under a capitalistic way is simply impossible of sharing enough wealth with the people who are on the bottom. And this is why you have a lot of the black people in the ghetto who claim that even black capitalism is simply a farce, that it won't work, because white America will not put enough money voluntarily into these programs. And I think this is why you have a lot of the black militant groups and also some of the SDS and other people who will opt for not a Stalinist Marxist type thing, but perhaps some kind of democratic socialism on the order that men like Dubček was trying in Czechoslovakia, or maybe what the Yugoslavs have achieved. But there certainly is a crisis of confidence among a lot of college people in the present system as far as its ability to share these blessings of technology with everybody. And you have this in another form, the fact that it's very difficult for business people to recruit a lot of your best students in the humanities and people who have had a liberal arts training to go into business. And a lot of times these people are coming away from the campuses empty-handed. They find even an opposition to going into business, that you simply can't keep your integrity and be a businessman. This is the way the feeling is among a lot of students.
I might attempt to make a comment too. Reinhold Niebuhr observed long ago that the existing system here in America is geared much better to remedying ills that occur within the upper strata of society or in relation to them, or middle class, upper or lower. That is, that what remedial measures we can take within our institutional structures are more appropriate to helping those who are somewhere at least within the top two-thirds or three-fourths of the income groups in the United States. I think that in looking at the entire world perspective here, one has to take into account not only the increasing antagonism to the existing order in places like the United States and in Western Europe. And incidentally, last summer, I talked to as many students in Western Europe as I could, and I found their views quite parallel to those of the students in the United States. I think you have to look at these areas in the third world that our concerned activist students are always complaining about, too, are directing their protests against our relationship with these parts of the world. And here is where the gap is so glaring, the disparity between wealth and poverty, for instance, in South America. Now, I recall hearing over in San Francisco in what was called a radical education series sponsored by the Glide Foundation, a Marinol priest who had become a revolutionary. And if you listen to his entire autobiography, in which he tells about how he first came to Guatemala, intending to follow the usual sacramental ritualistic approach of the Catholic Church as he had learned it, simply to celebrate Mass among the people. And then he came over to the decision that he would have to enter into social reform, and he tried all kinds of charity measures to try to help the people, and then found that to bring any meaningful changes in the government or in the existing order there, and he blamed it on American interference and American imperialism, as well as on the exploiters in Guatemala, that in order to do this, he had to become an outright revolutionary, and this was the only way that he could really fully identify himself with the cause of the people and with their aspirations.
Mr. Kleiner.
Jim, you have inherited years ago have become almost insoluble because
possessed with problems with some other source, from some other cause. And I think it's just entirely, I agree with Norman Mailer. I don't think there's any answer to the problem. And the fellow who wants to be mayor of New York City, in fact, thing is cool. And no wonder you don't know what the answer is. Now, the question is, I don't think you're alone. I wouldn't haven't even imagined a dream what an answer would be to the problem. But what will revolution do? That's my question. Is the answer revolution? What do you mean revolution? What are you talking about?
Well, let me react. For me, at this point, revolution is not the answer, and the others may react differently. I'm not quite sure why, whether it's fear. Whether it's just a part of the apathy, and I just feel if I put on a few more band-aids, I've done my task in life. But I am definitely not a revolutionary, and fear that if our community gets to that point, that I will be totally incapable of coping with the situation. I'm only attempting to say that. And I certainly don't preach revolution, obviously, then, because this, to me, would be the worst kind of lack of, what's the word, it would be, an irresponsible type of thing, because I'm not ready to follow through. I'm simply saying that it seems to me that nowadays, as I hear people reacting to problems, their reactions are more angry, more militant, and that if then the answer on the other side is merely repression, which seems to be taking place in our society currently, that whether I like it or not, and even though I may preach against it, it appears to me that revolution is coming. No, I'm not a I have too many hang-ups to be a revolutionary.
Well, I'd be the first to say we're not. You use the term.
Yes.
I wonder what you might
find. Yeah, I mean, I thought also this
is very well said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Most of you may be aware of this, but in Martin Marty's last book, The Search for a Usable Future, he has a chapter in which he tries to deal with this question of the Christian's relationship to a revolutionary situation. And I found this the most helpful part of his book. He draws a distinction between varying degrees of pressure, coercion, violence. And I think this is important, too. This term revolution itself can become an ambiguous term, which people are using in different senses. You could be referring to vigorous or sudden change, drastic change, or you may be referring to all-out violence with weaponry of whatever types are necessary to make your attempt to overthrow the existing regime. There is quite a variation here. And what he suggests, as I recall, is that a possible Christian approach here is to begin with searching for those means of reconciliation and renewal and reform that still seem to be possible within a society, no matter how deteriorated the situation has become. But then there may be a series of escalations here that the Christian has to resort to as the situation worsens and the confrontations become ever more serious. In other words, he's suggesting that at certain points, one may, through a kind of verbal proclamation, a very vigorous verbal proclamation, may be able to make some impression, some dent in the situation. You may come to the point where you're willing to endorse various types of indirect coercion or nonviolent tactics, nonviolent aggressive tactics,